This is another presentation of Tape Recorded UFO Information Service, a non-profit organization. The speakers are members of the Wigan Flying Saucer Group in England. And first we shall hear Mr. David Whiteman, chairman of the group and editor of the saucer periodical Uranus. And he will discuss the general saucer situation in England together with the activities of the Wigan Flying Saucer Group. Next, you will hear Mr. Harold Hill, also a member of the group, and he is a well-known amateur astronomer and lunar observer. His report was submitted to the British Astronomical Association late in July 1954, but this body has not commented upon or published Mr. Hill's report that was so promptly sent to them. This was in strange contrast to their usual friendly acceptance of his contributions. However, it was featured as a star item in the British press. No matter how one looks at the subject of flying saucers, here, at any rate, we have at least one record that can be relied upon for accuracy and unbiased, objective recording. For Mr. Hill has had over 21 years' experience in astronomical observation.
This is David Whiteman, speaking to you from Wigan, which is in the county of Lancashire in the northwest of England. I am chairman of the Wigan and District Flying Saucer Research Group, a comparatively small organisation by ordinary standards, boasting some 24 members, a number of which are university students. Our members are more than usually enthusiastic, but owing to their free time being restricted, the Wigan group has not found it possible to publish a bulletin of its own, much as we would like to do this. Our group is in an excellent position as far as receiving up-to-date news of the world saucer situation is concerned. For, as editor of the widely read saucer magazine Uranus, I receive all the other saucer signs from other countries. In addition, I have correspondence in practically every country which is known to have an active interest in the saucer mystery. Our group has been in existence a little over 3 years, being formed in the latter part of 1953, a year in England during which interest in the subject approached its peak. During these past 3 years, we have, quite naturally it seems, adopted a critical attitude towards the problem, assuming all the reports dealt with as being innocent until proved guilty, so to speak. Innocent of being a genuine flying saucer or UFO until no other explanation was thought possible. I think I can speak on behalf of all the members when I say that this attitude is vitally necessary if one is to avoid a kaleidoscope of conflicting theories. There is no aspect of the problem which has not been discussed at our fortnightly meetings, and our members, being so well read, would have a just right to claim themselves as fellow members of a ufological society, if such a society is ever formed. We have our own library, and this contains not only a very wide selection of books, but an amazing number of magazines, leaflets, and documents. Both myself and Mr. Harold Hill, whom you'll be hearing later on in this tape, are fortunate in owning tape recorders, and these have been made good use of. Any saucer programs which have been broadcast on our sound or television stations have been recorded and played at our meetings for assessment of accuracy and general usefulness in promoting serious interest amongst the general public. Both Harold Hill and myself have also used our tape recorders to interview witnesses or saucer sightings, several such interviews being in our tape library. I have given many lectures in the northwest of England and have met many interesting people while thus engaged. Most of you in America will remember the 13-year-old boy, Stephen Derbyshire, who, on the 15th of February 1954, succeeded in taking a photograph of a saucer. This photograph has been used extensively to prove the authenticity of a particular photograph taken by George Adamski. I have met the whole Derbyshire family on several occasions, and Mr. Harold Hill has met them once. On the first occasion I met them, which was only 6 weeks after the incident occurred, I was taken up to the spot where Stephen stood and took his photograph from. I also investigated the hill and valley beyond, where the saucer disappeared. We have no reason at all to suspect that the story Stephen told was anything but the truth. We have also met the 8-year-old boy, Stephen's cousin, who was also present at the time the picture was taken. Despite the fact that the Wigan saucer group has no bulletin or magazine of its own, we have been given quite a bit of publicity in the press. 2 newspapers are members of our research group. One question is being asked more than any other among genuine saucer investigators. They ask, are we making any progress towards the ultimate solution of the mystery? It is a question which cannot be answered easily and in a few short sentences. But if I was asked to give a straightforward answer, I think I would say, quite definitely yes, progress is being made. I am very often asked the more direct question, have you reached any definite conclusion as to what the sources are? I have been confronted with this question so many times that I have finally had to give it serious consideration, trying to evolve a stock answer to this, what I consider to be a very important question. It had to be an answer which took into account all the vast amount of knowledge and evidence I had accumulated during my years of study. It took some working out, but I am rather proud of the result, particularly as I have yet to hear anyone give a direct answer to this particular question. Well, you may ask, what is my answer? I contend that there is observational evidence in abundance and of a scientific nature to prove that there are spasmodically present within the atmosphere of our planet intelligently controlled objects which are not the result of engineering processes carried out on this Earth. It has become increasingly evident that satisfactory answers to many of the different questions relating to problems are not going to be arrived at by consideration of evidence of the hundreds of thousands of ground-to-air and air-to-air sightings alone. If, and I emphasise if, we can arrive at any conclusions at all from this type of evidence alone, it is only that they are extraterrestrial in origin and are intelligently controlled. Beyond that, we cannot go. Without having said so in so many words, I think that 90% of genuine investigators hold such an opinion. But we are now at a stage when other questions rear up before us. Questions which must be answered. Where do they come from? On a planet? If so, are they from planets in our solar system or from a system beyond? Directly related to the last question is the more technical problem of propulsion. It is true that with the advent of electrogravitics, speeds, accelerations and decelerations, and fantastic maneuvers attributed to UFOs in thousands of instances, seem possible, if not probable, with Earth-made craft. It is not just pure propulsion methods, however, which need solving. If it were just a matter of fantastic speeds and abrupt changes of direction, electrogravitics would seem not only plausible, but a likely answer. But also related to propulsion, we have the invisible and disappearing sources, as in the Nansei-Shoto riddle, related in Donald Keyhoe's latest book, and the well-known English sequence of sightings which occurred during Operation Mainbrace. During 7 consecutive days, 12 UFOs appeared on military and civil radar screens, always at the same time and going through the same sequence of maneuvers. On the last 3 days, the sky was clear, but those UFOs were flying at only 12,000 feet and should have been plainly visible. Nothing could be seen either from the ground or from the jets sent up to intercept the unknowns. During a 2-hour interview I had with an emergency spokesman in London in April of 1956, I asked for details of the investigation into the incident I have just briefly referred to. I was given an answer, but told that to repeat it would render me liable to prosecution under the Official Secrets Act. All I can say is that the answer did not satisfy me. I was promised also information regarding other incidents, but despite letters of reminder, this has not been forthcoming. Can electromagnetics explain the invisible and disappearing sources? The question of where they may come from seems practically insoluble, unless, of course, one believes George Adamski, Susan Bethlen, Daniel Fry, Arthur Angelusi, and a host of other persons who now claim contact with the saucers and those in them. The trouble with these accounts is that hardly any one agrees with another. George Adamski and his alleged contacts form a mystery within a mystery. Myself and the Wigan Group have conducted a most thorough investigation into these claims. We are especially well equipped for this, and I am in constant contact, with Mr. James W. Morley and Lonzo Dunn in America, both of whom have supplied a lot of information. It now seems practically certain that Adamski's claims are false. We have information which shows beyond doubt that George Adamski did not write "Flying Saucers Have Landed," and it is extremely unlikely that he wrote the second book, "Inside the Spaceships." As long ago as September the 20th in 1956, a tape recording of Harold Hill and myself's criticisms was sent to Dr. Ditmar. This tape was forwarded on to Mr. George Adamski. It is a long time now, and we have heard no reply or acknowledgement even of the tape having been received by Mr. Adamski. To be brief, unless some evidence of an extraordinary nature comes available, Adamski's claim must be regarded as false. Added to the more ordinary contact claims, if any of them can be labelled ordinary, we have monsters and little green men. I am at present engaged in trying to sort out a monster story which took place in New Zealand. I expect a tape recording with all the information relating to this affair to be in my hands early in the new year. I hope to be granted an opportunity to make another recording, more if possible, for I consider this tape service inaugurated by Dr. Ditmar and Mr. Henriksen to play a large and most useful part in the exchange of information which is likely to help in the ultimate solution of the enigma. And now, I take great pleasure in introducing my good friend, Mr. Harold Hill.
Thanks, David. At the request of the UFO Information Service, I'm giving here a detailed account of all the circumstances attending the observation of a truly remarkable sky phenomenon witnessed by myself and my wife on Thursday evening, July the 8th, 1954. From 9:30 p.m. to 9:55 p.m. British Summer Time. Earlier in the day, I had been making spectroscopic observations of the sun, and I'd left the shutter of the observatory dome open. Well, I went out at about 9:25 and closed it. But before returning to the house, I scanned the beautifully clear sky, routine sweep kind of thing, but the sky was showing signs of filling in with clouds from the southwest. Well, quite suddenly I detected at an altitude of about 55 degrees in the southern sky a bright, apparently stationary, star-like object resembling the planet Venus. It was, however, considerably brighter than even the lustrous Venus would appear on so bright a sky. And anyway, the planet was low down in the sunset. Immediately, thoughts of a supernova, or new star, flashed into my mind. And I rushed to the house to call my wife and get the binoculars. She immediately confirmed the object, and in the glasses, 8x30, the strange star, as we thought it was then, expanded into a small, bright, metallic looking globe. The clouds were now coming up and crossing the region, and they were very troublesome, and the object, when finally recovered, was seen to have shifted its position and was somewhat higher in the sky. Well, meanwhile, with feverish excitement, I'd opened up the observatory to bring the 12-inch reflecting telescope to bear. But a smaller 3-inch refractor, which I have mounted on the larger instrument for solar observation, fouled the cradle of the English-type equatorial, and with wild abandon, I simply tore the 3-inch from its supports in my anxiety to get the grips of the 12-inch. Whilst the star was readily visible in the finder, which is I might explain is an auxiliary telescope attached to the main instrument, the much smaller field of the high-power eyepiece could not be trained on the precise spot in the sky. And to avoid wasting valuable time, I had to resort to a much lower power, but having a wide field. For those interested, I might say that the magnifying power of this eyepiece was 50 diameters, and the extent of the field was 35 minutes, or rather more than the apparent diameter of the moon. Well, the object was picked up almost once, and what was seen was as amazing as it was unexpected. There was a principal bright silvery object of indeterminate shape. One simply couldn't draw it. It was accompanied to the left by a cluster of what appeared to be minute stars of different degrees of brightness, or the astronomer says magnitude. The components numbered from, I should think, 15 to 20, although it was very difficult to estimate the precise number, because the members of the cluster were constantly changing their positions independently of one another. The whole scene gave the impression of being one of great activity. It was utterly unlike anything that I'd previously observed in the heavens. My wife confirmed the appearance in the 12-inch. Well, clouds again intervened for a short time, and when these cleared, another surprise was in store. For now, there were two bright objects close together, and the cluster of small objects had completely disappeared. Were they still in the vicinity, but out of the field of view? Well, I couldn't say, and I couldn't waste precious moments sweeping for them. My attention was riveted on the two bright objects, which showed quite sensible motion in the field. They were gradually separating, and not only appeared to be gyrating and flashing, but they also exhibited a slow pendulum movement about each other in a manner rather suggestive of dancing partners. A truly astounding sight. One of the members was decreasing in brightness, and probably both were, because they were now lost to the view of my wife, who still had the binoculars trained. The increased movements of the object made following in the limited field of the 12-inch more difficult, and they passed out of the field as an adjustment had to be made in declination to the reflector. Continued sweeping of the region failed to recover them, and clouds finally brought observations to a close at 9:55 p.m. British summer time. The impression given was that the phenomenon was at a tremendous height, probably in the upper reaches of the stratosphere, or even beyond, because the small star-like objects of the cluster had shown no sensible size, even with a power of 50. As for the two principal members, these simply defied description. They flashed as they gyrated, as though metallic surfaces were reflecting the rays of the sun. Probably the closest analogy to what was seen is to be found in the flashing of the facets of a diamond as it is turned in strong light. I have been an amateur astronomer for, 21 years now, and I've been a member of the British Astronomical Association for 12, and I think I can claim to know my way about the sky, and I am convinced that this phenomenon was certainly not of astronomical origin. Well, I must admit at the outset that had I not already been acquainted with flying saucer literature, Having read the Leslie Adamski Flying Saucers Have Landed and both British and American publications on the subject, I would have found it extremely difficult to offer a satisfactory interpretation of what was seen through the telescope. And indeed, it was only much later that same night, or rather I ought to say in the early hours of the morning, for I couldn't sleep with excitement, that a possible, and I think probable, explanation occurred to me. What I couldn't understand at first was why the principal silvery object, the single silvery object I first saw, appeared to have become two in the later stages of my 25 minutes observation. And I believe now that what I first saw was perhaps a cylindrical or cigar-shaped object viewed end-on. And in the later stages, the object had turned sideways so that I could see both ends. And they were either illuminated or reflecting the light of the setting sun, so giving the impression of two separate objects. And this would also account for the pendulum movement around one another, at the body rotating around its longitudinal axis. Well, on this theory, what of the cluster of the attendant bodies which were later to disappear? Well, I offer the tentative explanation that these may possibly have been the so-called scout craft, having perhaps a rendezvous with a mother ship. Well, in spite of much publicity being given locally to this sighting, it was most unfortunate that it doesn't appear to have been observed, at least knowingly, by anyone else in Britain. At least no confirmatory reports were received. A reliable estimate of the object's apparent altitude and azimuth from another observer, say 15 or 20 miles distant, would have enabled us to form some idea of the true height of the phenomenon and also its true size ascertained.
Well, this has been a presentation of the tape-recorded UFO Information Service, a non-profit organization, and Dr. A.G. Dittmar, General Coordinator, H.M. Hendrickson, Technical Director.